Okay, thank you, Fred, and thank you to Miller Bernstein for hosting. Yeah, so my name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm the Sgan Rosh Kollel of the Yeshiva University, Torah Mitzvah, and Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. Okay, so the topic that I want to discuss today, the question of giving tzedakah, giving charity, or supporting those who could support themselves in a normal American election year, would be front and center of the political discourse, in some version of it. In at least in the states, fiscal conservatives, one of the central things that they oppose are the entitlements and the social and the safety nets that exist in the states, though they exist in a lesser form than in many Western countries, in more expansive form than many of the conservative elements of American political discourse would like. And the Democrats would normally be pushing for a more expanded welfare network. And the discussions that you'll hear often are, why should we expand it? There are admittedly people who need it, and there are people who could work but choose not to, or are disincentivized from working because of the existence of the safety net that the state provides. So in a normal election year, you would hear discourse about that, and the question I really want to explore with our eye on that overarching question is, it is clear that Jewish sources, the Torah sources, support the notion of charity. And to an extent, even for people who are somewhat guilty of being in the situation, they are. If someone is actually at the point of death, right, where he or she refuses to work and is actually starving to death, even if you hold them culpable, at some point there has to be a limit where you're going to say, despite the fact that they're guilty, we're going to step in at that last point. But where you draw that line, and at what point you say, well, yes, I want to help someone who is in an unfortunate situation, if you brought that about yourself because you chose not to work, or even you could have worked a minimum wage job that would have put food on the table, and I understand that's hard and maybe beneath your dignity, but you could have gotten out of the situation, right? At what point do we draw the line and say, you don't deserve funds of charity? That's meant for the people who really can't work. Right? So, for example, if you talk, I'm more familiar with the American discourse, just because that's where I lived until I was in my mid-20s, and then I went to Israel, which is a totally different system, and now I'm in Canada, which I still don't fully understand the system. But in the States, the elements of the safety net that people don't usually argue on are things like disability. If someone was hurt, especially in the process of working, and now they can't work, so very few people want to eliminate that component from the safety net that the state provides, because they understand those people really need the money from the government or from someone else. On the other hand, the classic example that is brought by the fiscal conservatives to explain why we need less of a safety net are the people, are the communities in the country which do exist. To what extent they exist is part of the dispute, where people choose not to work because the safety net provides enough that they could live a reasonable life without working. And you know, there are cities, again, how many cities exist, that's part of the dispute, where you'll see that most of the people who are buying food are not buying it with money or with a credit card. They're buying it with what they have in the States, an EBT card, I think it's called, right, which is basically food stamps but in a credit card form. You know, Yeshiva University, for anyone who knows, is in Washington Heights, where is one of the types of places they point to where there is a very high percentage of people. You very rarely see people using cash or credit cards to the point where if you use a credit card in any of the supermarkets, you have to provide ID because they don't believe you that you own a credit card, right? So so there are places like that, you know, that was, so you, anyways. So the question I want to deal with is that question, is do you have a moral responsibility towards people who really could work, who really are just relying on charity because they choose not to support themselves? Okay. So the first source that we'll look at is from the Talmud. So the Talmud is one of the most basic texts of Jewish law. And there, the Gemara says, number one, Tanu Rabban Ha'avet, so we have the Hebrew on top, we have the English on the bottom. So our rabbis taught, lend. There is a command 2, a commandment to lend money to those who need money, right, not as charity, but simply they need a loan. So this refers to someone, I mean, this obligation to lend somebody money when he needs it refers even to someone who has nothing and does not wish, this refers to someone who has nothing and does not wish to be supported from charity, to him to give the money as a loan and afterwards we give him as a gift. So the classic case where the Talmud says you should try to lend money to someone who needs money rather than give it as charity is someone who, because of their dignity, they don't want to accept charity. So instead, you say, look, I'll lend you money. I'm not giving you charity. I understand you're having a difficult time. I'm going to give you money so you can use it. You can use it for capital. You can get, you can through business, or I'm giving you a loan so that you can, with a little bit of peace of mind, you can look for a job and you don't have to worry about where the next meal is going to come from. And then when you see that he needs the money or she needs the money, and a loan is not going to cut it, so you sort of quietly turn it into a gift, right? You never ask them for it, you forgive it, you say forget about it, and you start it off as a loan to allow them to have the dignity of not feeling like they're getting charity. And then the Talmud continues, Havitenu. When the verse says you should lend him, it says it in a double language. Havet Havitenu, you shall surely lend him, or you shall lend him, you shall lend him. In Hebrew, instead of words like surely, you just repeat the verb. So Zesha Yeshlo ve'eino rotze lehitparnes, shenotlin lo shum matana v'chozin v'nifra'en eminu la'achar mita divrei Rabbi Yehuda. So Rabbi Yehuda says, what if it's the flip case? Let's say someone has no money. This is someone who has money, right? But he doesn't want to use his own money. He wants charity, right? He has his own resources. He has money. He just doesn't want to use them. So instead, he goes to the soup kitchen. So what do you do? So Rabbi Yehuda says, look, everyone agrees that he doesn't really deserve charity because he has money. But he's not eating. He's not going to eat unless you give him something. So Rabbi Yehuda says, he's caught. On the one hand, the person legitimately doesn't deserve charity because he has money. On the other hand, if you don't give it to him, he's refusing to eat. He's going on a hunger strike because he would rather die than touch the money in the bank. Okay? So Rabbi Yehuda comes up with a solution. He says, here's what you do. Give it to him. Tell him it's charity. It's not really charity. And then, after he dies, collect it from his estate. So this way, you, on the one hand, take care of him. On the other hand, it comes back to the coffers of charity. But the sages argue and they say, no, if he has his own resources and he doesn't want to support himself, so too bad. So then let him starve. And he has money in the bank and he's not going to go to the bank, then that's his problem. It is not our responsibility to take care of people who could take care of themselves. So, at first glance, this source seems to provide the beginning of an answer to our question. You have a dispute in the Talmud, right? You have a person who could support himself. The sages say, well, if he can support himself and he doesn't want to, well, then too bad. Mm-hmm. Let him, right? Let him starve. If he doesn't want to put in the effort to buy his own food, then too bad. And Rabbi Yehuda says, no, you do still have responsibilities to somebody who, right, you still have some responsibilities to someone who could use his own money. Okay. The problem is, well, at first glance, it seems like a good source and a good beginning of the discussion for our question. It's not exactly parallel to the modern question of, do you provide charity someone could work? Because, right, what is the implication? What type of person does it sound like we're talking about? Right, does it sound like we're talking about somebody who could work and get money and chooses not to work? It doesn't quite, right? It sounds like it's someone who has money and won't spend it. Right? And if you look in 2, that's how the Shulchan Aruch codifies it. That a wealthy person who starves himself and is miserly about his assets, not to eat from them, we pay him no heed. Now, that's a little bit different than our case. So if you jump to, I probably should have put it here, but if you jump to 6, right, there, my late teacher, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Lichtenstein, wrote an article on the responsibilities of the recipient of charity with, as we're doing now, an eye towards the political question. And he notes that while at first glance this source seems to begin our discussion, it doesn't actually, because he says we appear to be dealing with a miser who prefers to save and starve, or to take from charity, rather than use the resources already in his possession. Despite all the criticism that may be leveled against a passive person who takes no steps to help himself, he certainly cannot be compared to a person of means who mortifies himself. Even one who maintains that the latter is responsible for his lot can require the extension of assistance to the former. Or in other words, in very simple language, there's a difference between someone who is rich and wants you to give him money and someone who chooses to be poor. Because the person who chooses to be poor, in the end of the day, is still poor. The person who is rich and chooses not to use his own money is rich. And if charity is money we give to somebody who is poor, who is indigent, and therefore needs sustenance, in the end of the day, the guy may be a loafer, but he's poor and needs food and doesn't have the means. So one could say, one could argue, that even if we rule, like the sages, that when someone has money in the bank but doesn't want to use it for food, so then let him starve, that's his problem, that wouldn't be true in the case where we turn to the person and we don't say, look, take your credit card out and pay for food. Instead, we say, go get a job, because there's still a step removed from him getting enough money in the bank to pay for food, to pay for rent, to pay for basic necessities that doesn't exist in the case of the Talmud. So at first glance, while this source seems to be the beginning of our discussion, it doesn't seem to actually be an ironclad proof in either direction. We still don't know what to do with somebody who's legitimately poor, but perhaps poor by choice. Okay, despite that, there were some commentaries who extrapolated from this source and expanded it and said, no, there's really no difference between the two. So if you look, for example, in number 3 in the Shuvot of the Marash Dam, who was a Turkish scholar, I think, in the 16th century. So he writes as follows. There's no difference between one who has and does not want to support himself, and one who had no money extant, but he could not gain sustenance from somewhere else, meaning from work, craftsmanship, or business. For there are many who don't have money extant, but they can work or do something, and if they would be supported by the rich, the handful of grain would not satisfy the lion, right? Which is a rabbinic way of saying, right, that on the one hand, you could have argued that that first source provides no evidence in our case, because our case is really what happens if someone is poor by choice, not if someone is rich and chooses not to use his money. But the Marash Dam argues, well, it depends how you look at the question. If you look at the question, who is defined as poor, such that I need to support them, there's a difference between someone who has money in the bank he doesn't want to use and someone who chooses not to work and get money to pay for food. But if that's not the question, if the question is, how are, as a society, are we going to provide for people in need? The question isn't who's poor. The question is who's in need. And from the vantage point of not who is poor, but who is in need, the distinction, while it does exist, narrows. Because if someone could get a job, now we can argue about what it means could get a job, but let's take a clear case where the Marash Dam's argument would make sense. Let's say somebody quits his job, right? He just didn't like his job. It was too much. It provided food for him. It allowed him to put food on the table, pay for rent, pay for electricity, have clothes for his family. But he didn't like his boss. He didn't like the hours. It was too much. But then he's, the next week, right, realizes he doesn't have the money. And we'll take an extreme case. Let's say he's in synagogue and he sees his wealthy boss there and he asks for charity. He says, you know, I don't have a job anymore because I couldn't handle working. And now I don't have food to put on the table. I don't have clothes. The rent is due in a week. I don't have the money. Can I have charity? So the boss, being a nice guy, says, look, I'm not going to give you charity because I understand it was stressful. You quit in a fit of anger. You weren't thinking. Now you realize that it's worth having a job despite all the frustrations. I'm willing to give you your job back, but I'm not willing to write a check and give you charity. So in that case, which is admittedly a bit extreme, you hear and you understand why the Marashdam might argue that the difference between the person who has money in the bank and the person who could put money in the bank is not so different. Because this, right, you're offering the guy a job. If he turns it down, right, yes, at the moment he is poor, but still, he's not needy. So I think that in the end of the day, that distinction is going to be what drives much of this discussion, which is, what is charity about? Is it providing for the poor? In which case, it might even apply to people who choose to be poor. Or is it about providing for the needy? In which case, we have the right and maybe even responsibility to demand that a person do everything in his power or her power to avoid being needy. And I think that's really the question, right? What do we think charity is about? Okay, so let's continue through the sources and see how people speak to this question. So far we've seen that the Marashdam takes the firm position that charity is about providing for the needy, and therefore it is fair for us to demand of people to work or seek a way of getting money rather than asking for handouts. But if you look at number four, the Sefer Mitzvot Ketanot, which was a German collection of law, and I think in the 12th century, he seems to say differently. And he says as follows. In the context of the commandment of charity, in addition to the Torah saying, you should give charity, it also adds two interesting commands. One is what's called lo ta'ametz, which means lo ta'ametz et yadcha, do not tighten your fist. Right, lo tikbot et yadcha, right, don't tighten your fist, don't close your heart. In addition to the command to actually give charity, the Torah also tells you don't be tight-fisted, don't be cold. And one of the questions that the Talmud and then the subsequent authorities and commentaries deal with is, okay, why does the Torah add all of these different verbs, all of these different commandments in the context of charity? What's the difference between just saying, give charity to those who need, and saying, don't be tight-fisted? So if you look at four, the Sefer Mitzvot Ketanot, he says, this is the question he's dealing with. I just cut off the beginning of the long paragraph. But he says, why? What are we talking about? Why does the Torah say, don't tighten your fist? So he says, so you don't say, why should we help him? Why should we help him? If he wanted, he could make more than he needs. Thus, we are taught, don't tighten. Even if you think this, that should have been this, you violate, don't tighten, meaning tighten your fist. And he says, why does the Torah say more than just give charity? He says, don't tighten your fist. Because you might be tempted to say, why am I giving him money? I understand that he's poor, but he doesn't have to be poor. He could make a living. He doesn't need me to support him. He's just choosing to take handouts. So the Torah tells you, no, don't tighten your fist, right? Be kind. And therefore, go and give him money despite this. So at first glance, it sounds like he comes down and says, charity is about giving to the poor. And if he's poor, even if he could be not poor, don't be tight-fisted. Give him money, be kind, and give him money. And that would be the opposite of what we saw in the Marashdam, which is, no, charity is about giving to the needy, not to the poor. The problem is that this passage is a bit ambiguous, because when he says, don't say, why should I help him? He could get money. He could work. He doesn't need my charity. There's two reasons why you might say that. One is because he really could get a job, and therefore you begrudge the fact that he wants a handout instead of getting a job. Alternatively, he can't get a job, but you assuage your own feelings of guilt by telling yourself he could get a job. And it's ambiguous which one he's referring to. Right? Is he telling you, even poor people who are not needy deserve your charity? Or is he telling you, don't assume that poor people are poor people by choice. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Assume that they're actually needy and not just poor by choice. And if he means the latter, we have no evidence. The only thing we have evidence for is that in a case where there's actual ambiguity, you should give the poor person the benefit of the doubt, right? If someone comes to you and says, I really tried looking for a job and I haven't found a job yet, and you say to him, how could it be you didn't find a job, right? You're in your mid-30s, you have a master's degree in business. I don't believe you that the market is that bad that you couldn't find a job. It must be you're not working hard enough. And he says, no, I really tried, but the market's really bad. You know, my specific expertise, all the firms in the area already have someone who's taken that on. I'm looking. I promise you that I will, as soon as I find a job, I'm going to stop taking charity. I'm going to stop coming for welfare checks. But, you know, look, I need you, or not even welfare, I need you to extend my unemployment benefits, right? You should give them the benefit of the doubt. That may be all that it means. Okay. So far what we have, therefore, is we have some clear positions who say that charity is only to the needy and not to the poor by choice. One source which is ambiguous, which either means charity is to the poor, even poor by choice, or only means don't assume that someone who claims to actually be in need is a poor person by choice. And then we have the extreme case of somebody who's not even needy, who just wants charity so he doesn't have to tap into his bank account, where we in the end of the day reject that person for obvious reasons, because he's neither needy nor poor, he's just greedy, right? So if we had the three categories, right? Needy, greedy, and poor, right? Greedy, we don't know. Needy, we do. Poor, but not actually needy, or could get out of his state, is still going to be ambiguous. So that brings us to the next source. The next source, in number 7, does not apply directly to charity, but as we'll see, some of the commentaries take their cue from here. So, there is a commandment as follows. If you see somebody, and this happened, I assume, more in biblical time than it does nowadays. We can think about what the modern equivalent of this might be. But if you see somebody who is traveling with his animal, right, with his mule, with his donkey, with his animal of carrying a load, and then you see that the animal collapses, right, or is collapsing, and the owner needs help, either unloading the animal so that he can then reload it, or reloading the animal because everything is now collapsed on the floor. So there's a command that you have to help this person. You have to go, you help him reload the animal or unload the animal, whatever he needs, you have to help him, right? The modern equivalent might be helping someone, right, replace their tire if they're stuck on the side of the highway, right? That would at least be, right, some sort of corollary. But then the Talmud asks the question, what happens if somebody comes to help this poor owner of the mule? And he comes and he starts helping him load up the animal. And the owner of the animal sits back and says, look, I'm a nice guy. For me, if I load up the animal, it's in my best interest. If you load up the animal, you get infinite reward in the world to come because it's a commandment. I'm going to let you do it because for me, right, I need a break. I'm giving you the opportunity of a lifetime, right? I'm giving you the opportunity to be a nice guy and get the reward that God is going to give you. So at that moment, do you have to continue loading up the animal? Or you can say, look, the Torah tells me I have to help you. It doesn't tell me that you get to be lazy just because other people are around who have a responsibility to you as a human being, right? Part of helping is helping, not doing it for you. So the Talmud says unequivocally, halach v'yashav lo. Something got mixed up here, but halach v'yashav lo. If the guy sits and says, just skip four words, right? And he says, v'omer ho'ol v'alecha mitzvah, im ritzoncha lefrok prok, patur sh'ne'emar imo. If he says, look, I'm going to sit on the side, and I'm not going to help you unload my animal because it's your commandment, not mine, the answer is, you say, that's very nice, I'm going to go on my merry way, because the Torah says, unload the animal, emo, with him. Which means, if he's helping, then help him. If he's going to be lazy, you have no responsibilities towards him. In number 8, Rabbi Shlomo Ephraim Lunshitz, in the Kli Yakar, one of the late classic commentaries to the Torah, takes this as the principle in all interpersonal laws. Right? He says it's not just about loading and unloading animals. This is the rule everywhere. If you just look at the English, he says, this is an answer to some of the poor among our people who cast themselves on the community and refuse to do any work, even if they are able to engage in certain works or in some other endeavor that will bring food on the table. And they complain if they are not given whatever they are lacking. For God did not command this, but rather, you shall surely unload it with him, and you shall surely help him to lift them up again. For the needy person must do whatever it is in his power to do. And if, despite all his efforts, he fails to earn a living, then every man in Israel is obligated to support and strengthen him and to provide him with whatever he is lacking and unload even 100 times. So the Kli Yakar extrapolates from here to all cases. And he says, no, this one line in the Talmud teaches you the fundamental principle of interpersonal laws. You are responsible to help people in need. You're not responsible to do things for others, right? Who could do it for themselves, right? And the rule, therefore, is help the needy, don't just help the poor. Okay. So now what we have is a few basic sources, right? We have a few sources who clearly come down and say, greedy, don't support. The actual needy, support. People who are poor but could get out of it, don't support. Then we have some implications, possibly, that that's not the case. That at least with charity you have to provide for even people who are just poor, even if they could get out of the situation. Because push comes to shove, right now they can't put food on the table. Or you have indications that we should at least give the benefit of the doubt to people who might be poor by choice and might be actual needy. This is all nice and fine for a case of private charity, right? I, as an individual, am approached by someone who asks me for money. So now we have basically all the factors on the table, right? Some people say, I give him as long as he is poor, even if he's not needy. Some say, if he could get a job, I don't have to give it to him. But translating the individual law to the plane of the government or the national level is more complicated than simply saying, well, here are all the fundamental principles, and now the state is just a conglomerate of individuals, and therefore the same rules apply. Now, why would that be true? Right, intuitively, why is the state different? Right, why is it that the state discussion tends to have more sophistication to it than this, or more details to it, besides the fact that there's all the practical problems?
Less burdens among one individual to share.
Right. So on the one hand, right, the government might be able to provide, right, the state is not giving up as much as an individual who's giving $1,000 to somebody who needs money to pay for his rent, right? If the government builds a shelter, right, and isn't that discriminatory in terms of who goes in there, it's less taxing on them. So maybe you could say the standards of what the government owes to people is higher than what the individual owes to people. On the flip side, you could also say the exact opposite, which is, right, the state sets a budget in a way that individuals, right, don't quite in the same way, right? The state has this huge budget where their money, it's not like, you know, let's say a private individual sets aside his tithe, his 10% for charity. Now the question is, who does he give it to? Okay, so even if he gives it to a few people who don't really deserve it, how much of a difference is that going to make? So they'll go to the next person. But if the government is going to consistently make bad choices, right, it's going to create a society, right? Because on the one hand, yes, it hurts the government less. On the other hand, the government is responsible to more people and therefore might have to be more discerning, right? So the fact that the government is this huge conglomerate, is this huge overpowering, superstructure that has more money and more responsibility on the one hand, may tell you that it has more responsibilities towards people. On the other hand, it may have more responsibilities because it has more capabilities to be discerning. It also is setting policy, right? It's a government is responsible for asking the question, what do I want my society to look like? An individual, the worst comes to worst, as this person ends up being a loafer, it's not going to destroy the fabric of society. If government makes too many bad choices in terms of how expansive they are with welfare, with entitlements, right? Hence, even the dispute that emerged over the terminology in the States, right? The shift from welfare to entitlements, right? Carries with it implications, right? Welfare carries with it a negative, right? That I'm helping you, but it's something which you should be ashamed of, which dissuades people from taking it. The second you move it to the word entitlement, part of the argument went was you are changing the culture. You're more than just giving it to more people. You're telling people they have a right to this, and therefore if I have a right to it, why bother working? So, yeah.
Isn't there also a fundamental difference that the individual gives of his own free will and the government mandates that everybody pay their taxes?
Correct. Right? So there's also the question of where the money comes from. Right? Right, the fact that the government gets it from taxes means that it's forcing individuals to give up money that might make their quality of life better. And if it makes the wrong decisions, right, then yes, right. This part of the argument has in fact made it into this presidential debate, right? Because it makes it into every presidential debate, which is if you make the wrong decisions, it's the middle class who suffers. It's not the rich who can afford it, and it's not the poor who you give more entitlements to. Right? It's the middle class who you're saying can afford it, but we're telling you the reality on the ground is you can't. Right? The middle class left behind, yes. Right? It's also different because the government is responsible not only to the poor. Right? The individual is responsible to the poor. The government is responsible to everyone. Right? In a way that an individual isn't. Or let's give an example. The government is responsible to provide roads. Roads is something that even wealthy people need but can't provide for themselves because either they don't have the money, because as wealthy as you are, you can't build a highway. And even if you are, you know, a billionaire and could build the highway, any highway you would ever need, you don't have the infrastructure. You don't have the, right, you don't have the manpower. You don't have the institutions in place that could do it. So yes, the fact that on the one hand you're forcing money out of people, on the other hand you have responsibilities not just to poor, right? But you actually have responsibilities to the wealthy and the middle class as well, right? That would change the equation. So in the next source, Reichenstein notes some of these tensions. He notes that even with all these sources, right, we have not yet closed the discussion. All we've maybe done is provided some sophistication to the conversation. In the end, he's going to add yet another level of it. But just to read what he says. He says, on the one hand, there is the mitzvah of gemilut chasadim, meaning kind, with all the halachic and social obligations that it involves, which demand of the benefactor maximal assistance. On the other hand, there is a demand, perhaps no less legitimate, to minimize the aid and share the burden. This demand has at least three components, one related to the limitations of the benefactor, and two connected to the welfare of the recipient. First of all, since we're talking about dividing up limited resources, generosity towards one person always comes at the expense of his fellow, right? That is the nature of charity in general, but for sure on the governmental level, right? It's easier to see. You can see the budget, right? If you put more money in entitlements, you put less money in defense, or alternatively, you raise taxes. The money is coming from somewhere, and you draw this huge this right incredibly complicated budget, and you can see where things are coming from. This consideration is true about every act of benevolence, but it's especially valid with respect to a public system built on the money and efforts of others upon whom are made coercive demands. Right? As Jacob said, this is not just that you're asking people, please give money that will go to entitlements. You are passing legislation that will force them, that they will not even understand. They will not understand why they're giving money. There is no way they can possibly understand, right, why you're getting money. They're just going to sign that check at the end of the year, have it taken from their paycheck, and then they're going to go to their account at the end of the year and find out magically whether they get more money to pay for things they need or whether they owe money and they have even less money in the bank than they thought. And it's not just coercive, right? If you think about the reality, this is not quite as bad in Canada from what I gather as in America. But in America last year, there were more changes to the tax code than there were days in the year, right? So you people have no way of knowing in the end of the day how much money they're going to have, right? So if you make a decision in the middle of the year, they may not even be able to right, calculate their budget. And the people on the border, right, may end up needing money or needing taking entitlements if you make the wrong decision, because they don't even know what it's going to look like. They don't know what their bank account is going to look like at the end of the year based on how you write the tax code. Second, he said unqualified giving, even if it were it possible in a practical and budgetary sense, is liable to clash with the fundamental objective of any relief plan. He said point two, and this is true on an individual level, but even more on the governmental level, and that's what we noted before. The government's responsibility is also to set the tone for society, right? And he says, therefore, when you think about the types of charity that everybody agrees should exist, right? Not charity, let's say entitlements, right? The first one that always goes up there is disability and unemployment, right? At least temporary unemployment, right? Because someone who lost their job, who'd been working for 30 years, and now, through no fault of his own, his job was outsourced, and the government gives him, let's say, 3 months just to be able to put food on the table while he looks for another job. So a highly qualified, I don't know, doctor, lawyer, right, businessman doesn't have to take a minimum wage job in the 3 months and under, right, and work for a job which he's way overqualified for. But the fact that you provide him a few months to remain on his feet while he looks for a job that he actually deserves, that actually is qualified for, is that type of entitlement is different than lifelong entitlements to someone who could work. The goal is the rehabilitation of the recipient to the point that he is capable of standing on his own 2 feet, emotionally and functionally. And his proof is that Maimonides, in his list of the 8 levels of charity, puts at the top giving somebody a job, right? Allowing him to no longer need charity, to transform someone from someone who is needy to someone who is not. So he said, if Rambam placed at the top of the scale of charity a person who assists a poor Jew by providing him with a gift or a loan, or by accepting him into a business partnership, or by helping him find employment, in a word, by putting him where he can dispense with other people's aid, then it is clear that the highest goal in helping a person who has already fallen low is the restoration of his independence. It is precisely abundant aid that is liable to block the attainment of this goal by intensifying the reality and the feeling of dependence to the point of degeneration and even paralysis of the emotional strength that are necessary for the rehabilitation process. And by the way, when I was a philosophy major. So, you know, one of the things you read in ethics that they like in modern textbooks, you'll find, is a speech that was given at the UN on behalf of I think it was one of the ambassadors from one of the African countries, where he begged the United Nations to stop the aid. He said, the reason that we still need aid is because you provide aid. Right? He said, because the fact that the West, first world countries, perpetually view third world countries as third world countries who need aid makes them remain third world countries who remain aid. Stop the aid for a little bit and you'll see that people will suddenly find work, will find a way of being productive. The only reason we're still third world countries is because you made us third world countries by making us dependents. Right? That's true on national levels. That can be true domestically. It can be true in communities. And lastly, the participation of the recipient is necessary for his moral benefit, no less than for his psychological benefit. He said, besides for the fact that this is necessary to have a functioning society, there's also something moral about it, right? People celebrate the culture where people have a work ethic, where people are hardworking, where people care, where they care about their family enough to work and they understand the cost of building society, of building a family. That's important not just practically, that's important morally for the fabric of society. He says this clash necessitates a dual approach. He says the fact that on the one hand, we're worried about those who need money, but we also want to enable them to be free of aid necessitates a dual approach. In the spirit of the words of Napoleon, that a person should pray as if everything depended upon God and fight as if everything depended upon him. When relating to the needy person, what ought to encourage personal effort and stimulate self-confidence? This point has a universal moral foundation, but it draws special strength from the enormous emphasis that Judaism places on free will. Right? He says this is true even if you're secular, you don't believe in God. There's a benefit to having a moral, hardworking society. But he says, right, in Jewish thought, it's even more. It's also theological. Free will, the idea of giving people the ability to choose and choose their own path in life and not have it dictated by others, including those who provide their welfare checks, is of paramount importance. In 10, Rav Shlomo Levi, who is a current authority in Israel, cites his father, Rav Yehuda Levi, as saying that he goes as far as to say that if you give money to someone who doesn't need it because he could work, you violate, there's a prohibition called placing a stumbling block before the blind, right? Where you trip somebody, right? Because he doesn't even realize that he's about to fall, right? The metaphor is, right? The blind person doesn't realize he's about to fall, so you can't put that block in front of him. Well, the person who's going down the path of relying on entitlements doesn't realize what that's going to do to him. And if you don't give him that wake-up call and say, look, I'm not going to give you the entitlements unless you at least try to get a job, right? He's going to be in a place not just where you don't want him to be, where he doesn't want to be. Okay. Now, despite all this, Rav Moshe Feinstein does, in fact, believe that if someone is responsible for his poverty, you have to support him. But as we've noted, there seems to be a tremendous amount of evidence that giving money to people who could work, who could get themselves out of this situation, is not just a problem for society, but is bad because you're harming the person himself. You're not allowing him or her to live the fullest type of life that he or she could live. Now, Rav Lichtenstein adds here one last level of, let's say, sophistication. And this is on a theological level. Right? So far, we've talked about the practical levels, the moral levels. But he said, there's even one more level to it. He said, I think at some level this question comes down to why are we nice to others? And there's really two reasons. There are two commandments in the Torah that tell us we should be nice to others. One is, v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, love your fellow as yourself. One is the moral dimension. The second is, v'halachta b'drachav, walk in the ways of God, or in Latin, imitatio Dei, right? Imitate God. And Rav Lichtenstein in 14, I'll say it outside. He says, at some level, this tension is a function of these two perspectives. He said, look, the basis of v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, or the golden rule, is do to others what you would want them to do to you. And if you are hardworking, and you think everybody should be hardworking, and you actually work for that money to put food on your table, and someone else could work but he doesn't, then you're right. You don't have responsibilities towards him because you're loving him like you love yourself. You're offering him to find him a job. You're offering to help him stand on his own 2 feet. That's what you would want someone to offer you, and he doesn't want it. So then your responsibilities dissipate. But God is a bit more forgiving, right? Because God forgives us even when we don't deserve it. We ask God for forgiveness. We say, look, I understand I've done things wrong that I shouldn't have done. And yet we turn to God and we say, forgive us. Because we understand that sometimes there are things we should be doing, we could be doing, but we don't do them because we're weak, because we're human. We don't always do what's best for us. So Rav Lichtenstein says, insofar as you're just looking at it from a moral perspective, yes. If someone chooses to be poor, that's his problem. But insofar as we remember that sometimes we turn to others, such as God, and say, look, please help us, even when we don't really deserve it, we might say the same thing to other people, right? And say, look, he doesn't really deserve it, but if I want God or I want others to help me, even when I don't really deserve it, so maybe I have to help someone who's poor, even if he's not really needy, because in the end of the day, he's in a state of being where he is poor. But despite that, despite the fact that Rav Lichtenstein says this is true, he notes two last points, right? One I've already mentioned before is that even though the brunt of the evidence is that the Torah doesn't think you should encourage people to be dependent and therefore, if at all possible, you should not be supporting people who could not be poor, right? Who are poor but not needy. He believes, but he doesn't know where to draw the line, that there must be a line. Right, there must be a point at which you say, I understand that he's being lazy, I understand he's being a loafer, but he's starving, or his kids are starving, right? And it's not the kid's fault, right? You hear this, you know, as part of the dialogue, that yes, the parents are lazy, but the kids are on the street, and therefore you still need to have shelters, because it's not fair to the children. He says there must be a line. Where that line is a hard question to answer. But when you know, conservatives and liberals are having the dispute, they have to at least admit that there are parameters here. And they can argue, and intelligent people can argue where to draw the line, as long as they recognize there are legitimate reasons pulling you in both directions, pulling you towards each pole, where you find your comfort zone between the poles. There must be a place between them, right? There must be some mercy, even for people who don't deserve it, when the consequences are too dire. And there must be some responsibility on behalf of people to fend for themselves, right?
Okay, but let me ask you something. Supposing you've got a case, say, where a person is working, he's getting his means, but he's claiming, oh, my financial situation is terrible. You walk past him, you smell, he's smoking 4 packs a day. And you could say to him, well, give up your habit.
Correct.
And you'll, and then
I think that's totally legitimate. Because that, I think, is more like the first case, the guy who's just greedy. Right? That's the, similar to the guy who has the money in the bank, right, and just chooses not to use it. That's the person, I think, yes, who is at one pole, the one where we say, no, you don't get anything. I think that's true. Okay. And the last paragraph here, I'll just read it because I think it summarizes what we've said. He says, the degree of recognition depends in no small measure on the idea of free will. This is why the halachists will be inclined to adopt an ambivalent attitude towards the struggle over welfare budgets across the Western world today, between conservative politicians who are stingy and social workers who are generous. On the one hand, halacha is excessive valuation of chesed and of society's responsibility towards the needy brings him to support the expansion of aid. But on the other hand, the more that this demand is based on the argument that aid must be expanded because psychosocial circumstances fetter the needy and prevent them from joining the workforce, it clashes with the emphasis that Judaism places upon free will. So at the end of the day, what I think the answer is, and this is what's often lost, I think, in political discourse, is that there are real reasons to want to minimize aid, A, for practical reasons, because of budgetary concerns, and B, for the sake of individuals, right? Because we want to see them be productive members of society for their moral, well-being, theological well-being, whatever you say, for their rehabilitation, that's important. On the other hand, there are consequences too dire that society should not accept, right? Like people just dying and starving in the street. The argument between conservatives and liberals shouldn't be, should we have no entitlements or a full welfare state? It should be, how do we find a balance that is true to the actual competing values that any thinking person should have? The question should be not about what values animate our discussion, but where do you draw the line so we, as best as possible in a complicated situation, actually give credence to the truth of both of the poles? And I think that on Election Day is, if nothing else, a good message. And please God, the results of tonight will be good, and we'll know it like 10 o'clock.